Back together again, you and I chatting it up, wrapping up a busy week, Friday, July 18th, 2025, right here on Connecticut Today. We took a close look at more solid poll numbers for Governor Ned Lamont, despite criticism from Republicans and many progressive Democrats as well. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso joined us with his weekly update and reaction to those same poll numbers. Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Journalism and Chair of the Journalism Department, Ben Bogardist, analyzed an announcement by CBS that the network is ending The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And former Time Magazine senior reporter and professor emeritus of political science at St. Peter's University in New Jersey, Alan Sanders, dropped by once again to talk about the current controversy surrounding the Trump White House and the Jeffrey Epstein files. So a lot of us have undoubtedly been at a game, an athletic event, right? Either a pro game or a college game or even a high school game or a youth game, a softball, little league, whatever. Top to bottom, pros down to rec league, beer league, whatever. And when the fans on one side or the other start chirping each other, "Yeah, you suck, get out of here." One side, invariably the side that's winning, will start a chant, right? And you and I, especially if we were involved in some way, shape, or form, whether we played high school athletics or went to the game, or like me, broadcast college athletics even back in high school, invariably the one response that drove the other side nuts, or the opposing fans if they were in your gym or your rink, or the home fans if you were winning a road game, invariably we'd have people that would take their finger, point up high, and no, not give you the finger, but point up high, and they would start chanting, "Scoreboard." Remember that? "Scoreboard. Scoreboard." Meaning, you can say and scream and bitch and moan and say all the stuff you want against us. Look at the scoreboard. We're winning. Our side is winning. And that was particularly satisfying if you were, playing somebody that you just couldn't stand. So I say that because yet another new measure of the popularity of Governor Ned Lamont has come out. And I find this interesting because he always does pretty well in these surveys. And it's interesting because you've got politically diametric sides trying to take the guy out. Of course, the Republicans would love to get back in the governor's mansion in the big leather chair. Why wouldn't they do that? And now you have a cadre of progressives led by Saud Anmar and Josh Elliott and Han Hughes that talk about Ned Lamont like he's the worst thing since recorded time, especially when it comes to workers' rights, union rights, and housing and all that. But I'm telling you, the governor and his people are having a scoreboard. They're having a moment here. Another survey here from Morning Consult, or Morning Consult, however they want to pronounce it. Governor Ned Lamont is the third most popular governor in the U.S., third most popular Democratic governor, I should say, in the U.S. He's got a 63% approval rating, 29% disapprove, and the rest, hey, they have no idea what day it is. But I want you to think about that here. And is all of this, is Ned sitting back laughing here? Now, let's assume 63% is wrong, just for the time being. Because whenever you see surveys, you look and you say, all right, it can't be that high. All right, let's say it isn't that high. Let's say it's 10% off. He still would be at 53%, and there's no way this is 10% off. Morning Consult does a pretty good job. Are they completely accurate? No, no pollster is. But again, he's been in the low 60s in this poll every time it comes out. Now, one reason that number is probably lower is because it's registered voters, not likely voters. And I've told you the best voting screen when they screen out the, responsible and reliable responses here is likely voters. if you do registered voters or adults, it tends to screw up the numbers a little bit. But even so, 63 to 29, which is gaudy, man, that's gaudy. 63 to 29, Governor Ned Lamont is among the most popular governors in the state. So are the progressives in his party kidding themselves? Are the Republicans kidding themselves? Look, it's not like you see these. I think the lowest I saw Ned Lamont at a poll of any import was like 53 or 52%. You would have to convince me. I would have to see that number in three or four polls to say, yeah, he's really at about 50%. Now, a lot could change once campaigning begins, if, in fact, he's running for a third term. But whether or not he runs for a third term, that's immaterial to what I wanted to start with today. At 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, that is completely immaterial. My question is, can this guy be beat? Will he be beaten, however you want to say it, proper English here, Paul? But can Aaron Stewart beat him? Can Josh Elliott beat him? Can Saud Anwar beat him? Can Ryan Fazio beat him? Will Jen Tucker beat him? Jen Tucker, I should say. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But it's funny that when you bring up the subject of Ned Lamont, either to progressives on the left or a lot of Republicans that I know and chat with on the right, it's like they're talking about Attila the Hun. Well, explain this to me. Explain to me, Lucy. How is it that Ned Lamont, if this guy is so awful, and I'm not saying he is or he isn't, how is it that he's got a 63% approval? He is constantly in the upper 50s or low 60s, according to this poll, and generally in the mid-50s. I'm sorry, I said upper 60s. That should have been upper 50s. Have you ever seen a poll with his approval ratings below 50%? I haven't. So it begs the question, who's more out of touch here? Is it the Republican candidates? I don't know. The Republican Party? Is it the Democratic Party? The far progressives in the Democratic Party, like Saud Anwar? And you've got people like that legislator out in the eastern part of the state whose name escapes me, Ann Hughes, Josh Elliott. Oh, we've got to defeat Ned Lamont. Well, apparently, you may be preaching in an empty church, guys, because he is still month in and month out when Morning Consult does these polls. The guy is one of the most popular governors in America. Where's the outrage? Oh, we got to get rid of Ned Lamont. Says who? Like I said, scoreboard. So I start with this today, and I want you to give this some thought. A new survey gives Governor Lamont a 63% approval rating. Will he win if he runs for a third term? Who can beat the guy right now? Of course he can lose. I get it. It's an eternity between now and November of next year, and you have the nominating conventions on both sides. But are all sides misreading this guy? Well, Connecticut deserves better. We need more progressive policies. Well, Connecticut deserves better. We need more conservative policies. Well, apparently, 63% don't think so. Are people just missing the boat on this guy? When the critics see Ned Lamont, they see something. But apparently, 63% of people in this survey, they don't really see that. So do both sides have it wrong here? As we're up and underway on a Friday, 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And listen, Lord knows, doing a show like this, my friends who host at other radio stations around the state, New Haven and out east and up in Hartford, like, we hear a lot of this. Ned Lamont sucks. Got to get rid of Ned Lamont. He's awful. Got to get rid of him. He's not far left enough, or he's too far left. We need a Republican in there. Okay. And again, there's a long time to the election. I get it. I understand it. But in almost, I can't remember a survey where he's done really bad. The guy's been elected twice. Both times were pretty much blowouts. And he may run again. And I know there are people saying, well, he's vulnerable this time. And what? Well, is he? Or are you just dealing in fantasy land here? More than 3 in 5 Connecticut voters approve of the performance of Governor Ned Lamont. That's according to a new poll. It makes Lamont, says here in Hearst, one of the nation's most popular governors. New survey from Morning Consult released this week, 63% of registered voters. Now, again, as I tell you, registered voters is not the best screen. Likely voters is, but registered voters ain't too bad. It's not perfect. It's not great. 63% of registered voters approve of Lamont, 29% disapprove, another 8%. They don't know. They had no opinion. They didn't care. So where does that put Ned Lamont? It ranks him 6th among all governors, not just Democrats or Republicans. He's number 6 in the country. And again, I know what you're saying. Well, these surveys can be off. Yeah, they can be off. I get it. I understand it. But you got to measure things some way, don't you? Could this change? Of course it can. Is the power of incumbency very powerful? Sure is. He is the 3rd most popular Democratic governor in all of the U.S. So out of all the blue states, he's number 3. He ranks number 6 among all governors. There's only 5 people in front of him. Republican Phil Scott of Vermont. Republican Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota, Democrat Andy Beshear of Kentucky, who could be the Dems nominee in 2028 because he sounds and looks a little normal, Mark Gordon of Wyoming, a Republican, and Democrat Josh Green of Hawaii. Now, let's remember, as it says here in this story, he easily won re-election in 2022. That Bob Stefanowski race, that was a blowout, and I told you what was going to happen. And the Republican Party, now look, Aaron Stewart, I think, would be a fine candidate. I'm sure Jen Tooker would be fine. I'm sure Ryan Fazio would be fine. All 3 sensible, youngish people. But come on, the Republican Party in Connecticut works in the suburbs. I get it. And to a point, they work in the General Assembly. But the flag bearers of the party... disasters over the last several cycles. I'm not saying they're bad people, but yeah, they were bad candidates. Bob Stefanowski, 0-2, fine guy. I talked to him a few times, but I'm dealing here where the rubber meets the road. Tom Foley, 0-2. Linda McMahon, 0-2. Leora Levy, 0-1. When does it stop? Maybe it doesn't. I told you, we will be vacationing on Mars before there's any sort of Republican wave in this state. And I'm not blaming the Republican Party or the critics of Lamont per se, because there will always be critics. No matter how popular a man or a woman is, and no matter what seat they carry, there's always going to be critics, and that's good. There should never be 100% agreement with a person 100% of the time. That's not good for any system. But it makes me laugh. Now, look, the Republicans are at a disadvantage in this state, numbers-wise. I get it. But I look at these numbers and say, what in the hell, what is the progressive wing of the Democratic Party thinking here? Seriously. Nothing personal against Josh Elliott or Saud Anwar or Ann Hughes or people like that or Martin Looney or Bob Duff. But what the hell are these people thinking? Well, you know, the governor's got to do more. Apparently he doesn't. The guy, like I said, even if this survey is off a little, let's say it isn't 63%, shall we? Let's drop it down 6 points to 57%. That would be 57-43. And that, my friends, in all political conundrums, is a blowout. You want to talk about that scoreboard chant in high school, 57-43 or 56-43. that Bob Stefanowski got beat by. You know what chant that starts in a high school game in the fourth quarter? Remember this one? Start the bus. Start the bus. That's an early and easy blowout. I don't get it. Explain this to me. How is it that people can say Ned Lamont's an idiot, he's a fool, he's not doing all this stuff, and the guy's at 63% approval? Maybe Ned Lamont's having the last laugh. I don't know. Maybe you have both sides here in Connecticut, the extremes of both sides. And I'm not saying Ned Lamont shouldn't be, you know, criticized if he does stuff wrong. Lord knows I've said that here. But it's incredible, especially for what we've seen now for the past couple of weeks, you know, coming out of the far left of the Democratic Party. Oh, the guy's got to retire. He's got to retire. It's time for Ned Lamont to step aside. He's got to retire. He's out of touch. Out of touch? He's got a 63% approval rating. If that's out of touch, whoever says that's out of touch, they got to push themselves away from the weed buffet. You know what I mean? Stop the gummies. You're supposed to take one and wait a few hours. Stop popping them like they're Skittles. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Simple question. Will Ned win if he runs for a third term? How's he going to lose, at least at this point? Now, he could lose, I get it, but he's got a 63% approval rating. And even if that's off by a half dozen points, it would still be 57%. What are the critics of Ned Lamont missing here? What are they missing? You tell me. What are they missing? The way they talk about this guy, he's lucky to be at 50%. I got news for you. He hasn't declared. Right now, he's having a good chuckle. All right, we look forward to this gentleman joining us every week right around this time, 5:15 or so. Former Democratic Rep, State Rep Chris Caruso, with his thoughts on all things Bridgeport and Connecticut. Chris, good to have you with us again. And if you listen closely, Chris, you can hear Ned Lamont laughing, I think, at another new poll that says, well, hey, if I'm so bad, how am I pulling 63%? And, Chris, you have talked about this, that, and you're warning progressive Democrats, the real far left of the party here in Connecticut, that they may be out of touch here with what the general Connecticut voter thinks of the governor.
Yeah, you know, it's been years, Paul. Again, I think that our last call, I went through a litany of people who ran who were progressive. They won the primary, but then they lost the general election. And I don't see Connecticut changing in that. I think if I were to sum up one word about Ned Lamont, is approachable. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a guy you can go up to, you can talk to. I remember a couple of years ago at the Bridgeport Columbus Day Parade, he came to march in the parade. He came up to me, gave me a big handshake. How you doing?
Yeah.
Asked me about some Bridgeport issues that I gave him my thoughts on. And that's the type of guy he is. And the other thing is, you would never know he's a millionaire.
Yeah.
Here's a guy who walks around with sometime no jacket, just an open collar shirt,
yeah.
Right? Gets up and speaks and off the cuff in many ways. Is he perfect? No. I always worry about politicians who think they're perfect.
Hmm.
This guy isn't. But, you know, he's honest. I think he makes decisions based on his gut, what he thinks are the best interests of the state. And I don't think he can ask for anything more of a politician, frankly. You know, I was always told when I was coming up politically, if you feel something strongly, you vote for it or you vote against it,
mm-hmm.
as long as you can explain your reason. And I think that's what Ned Lamont does. And there's a reason why he's polling so high. It's that approachability. It's the common approach. He's a gentleman. He's courteous to people. The other thing, he works across the aisle.
Yeah.
You know, are Republicans crazy about him? No, at times they're upset. Are Democrats? No, they're not always crazy about him either. But he gets to the middle, and I think it shows in the state. You don't have these hand grenades being lobbed back and forth as we do in Washington and places like that. There's a civility that's maintained, and I think in large part because of Ned Lamont.
And you know, Chris, I think he realizes, and I think it shows in his poll numbers, that outside of the great cities like Bridgeport and Hartford and New Haven and Danbury and Waterbury and Middletown and New London, there's a whole other quote unquote Connecticut out there that he's the governor of too, not just the cities.
Sure. Yeah, you know, and I when I represented Bridgeport, there were issues that didn't directly affect Bridgeport, but I felt I needed to do as a representative. There were issues by certain organizations that were upset with me because I voted the way I did. But you know what? I wasn't there to represent a specific organization. Mm-hmm. I was there to represent my constituents. The other thing is, he has passion for this position. I think he really enjoys it. I think he's having some fun with it and getting things done. And as long as he has the passion and the desire, I think, you know, if he runs, frankly, it's for Ned Lamont to lose. I think he'll win again. You know, the big issue, House Bill 5002, which mm-hmm. is the housing bill.
Yeah.
In September, the legislature's coming back. Something will be put together, and that issue will not be an issue any longer. The other one is with the unemployment fund with the striking workers.
Yeah.
I think that will be worked out. So then what does the progressives have to run on? Now, those are the two big issues they have, right?
Yeah.
So if those are settled, where do you go with it? So I think that's the, what's happening right now. I think people are relatively happy with Ned Lamont, and I think they'll stay with him. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, it's a long time to the primary, to the primary or the election. But I think right now, you know, I think he's sailing fairly well.
Chris, talking about passion, and of course the guest every week at this time, Chris Caruso, I was heartened to see and hear the comments yesterday of Chief Roderick Porter and Mayor Joe Gandam in Bridgeport, and even Senator Blumenthal, the outrage about this clemency given to Adrian Peeler here. Horrible case. I mentioned earlier a couple of my friends covered this case years ago, and all these stories are bringing back the stuff that they heard in the courtroom there, covering it for radio and television. But boy, I got to tell you, Chris, and I know there are probably legalities. We're never going to find out what we want to find out. But man, I was stunned. We knew about this a couple of months ago, but man, this was stunning. What are your thoughts on that? Because I'm sure that's etched in your mind as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Paul. And I even conveyed that to the mayor. It's really outrageous. You know, B.J. Brown and his mother were constituents of mine in the North End.
Mm-hmm.
And when the killing took place, it was hard for me to wrap around the idea that someone would shoot an 8-year-old child. I just couldn't imagine that happening. But they did, and they killed the mother as well. And keep in mind, B.J. was the star witness for the state. If you recall, and he was going to testify, and that's why he got killed. And at that time, the judge who presided over the case apparently gave the list of witnesses to Peeler's defense attorney and didn't redact the addresses. So in turn, it must have gotten to Peeler. He knew exactly where these people were living. And I got on the floor that time, and I worked against the judge. We got over 40 votes to oppose his reappointment. It was unconscionable that he didn't put that child and mother in witness protection. So after BJ dies, we create what's called the Witness Protection Program, and we named the program after BJ Brown. Now, usually in the legislature, it's not named after individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the heinous act that took place against this child, I think my colleagues felt there was a need to recognize it. But it just shows the heinous act of killing an 8-year-old child and his mother, and then, you know, being given clemency, which was unconscionable. And I think that's what worries most people.
Yeah.
You know, when Peeler comes back, coming back to Bridgeport, we don't know. Will he seek revenge? Who knows? He may also be a target by people who will try to kill him. We don't know. But once again, you know, to do clemency on this person was wrong. And it puts Bridgeport and the safety of the people of the city at harm.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
And Chris, finally, I don't think when the founding fathers wrote up and proposed powers of clemency and pardons to the chief executive, they weren't thinking of a case like this. Obviously, Chris, they were looking out for somebody who was subject to a phony prosecution, a government prosecution, somebody who could not have who did not be able to afford a suitable defense attorney, or they were. It's not about this. I'm outraged about this. I really am.
Yeah. And, you know, Paul, I'm a Democrat. I think everyone knows that. And I'm proud of being a Democrat. I don't shy from it. But I'll tell you, I'm outraged at Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in all fairness, for him to do that is unconscionable. Now, I'd like to find out who was
yes.
the person that submitted
mm-hmm.
the pardon, right?
Yeah.
Or who put it in? Was it someone from Connecticut? What was an elected official? Was it individuals in the Congress? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's the first place. Find out what happened. But at this point, we don't know where Peeler is. You know, he could have been released. We don't know if he's coming back to Bridgeport. He's going somewhere. We have no idea.
Mm.
So people are on edge. Families on edge. We get it. But, you know, when I look back, an 8-year-old child, my God, how heinous an act that is. It's just terrible.
Depravity. Terrible. Chris, thank you. Have a happy weekend.
Okay.
Chris Caruso, and we'll chat with you next week. Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris Caruso. Is he coming back here? And Chris is right. Who started the process? That's what we need to find out. Who started the process? And believe me, much more influential or far more influential people than me are asking that simple question. A lot of people not happy. Now, a lot of the country doesn't care, but a lot of people not happy with the kind of whispered implications of an announcement from CBS Television, the entertainment division, and Stephen Colbert saying Late Night with Stephen Colbert is going to be done next year. See you later. Goodbye. Now, the guy was getting paid a lot of money. The demographics were still good, but is there more behind this? Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Journalism and the Chair of the Journalism Department, a return visit from Ben Bogardus to talk about this. Hey, Ben, it's Paul. How you been? How are you?
I'm doing well.
So, what do you think here? Because, Ben, a lot of people maybe from my generation that you probably have talked to on this are saying, is this a Smothers Brothers thing all over again from the Nixon years? But are people, Ben, you think, reading too much into this or not? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think it's one of those situations where two things can be true at the same time, because Paramount, the owner of CBS, wants to merge with a company. They need regulatory approval. So they are trying to sort of make nice with the government and the Trump administration. But at the same time, you know, the demographics of late night TV and TV in general are also changing. And I can see an argument where, you know, Stephen Colbert making a lot of money, high production costs, New York City, large staff, things like that. And the network is saying, you know, people aren't watching live TV anymore. They're more into streaming. Younger people are just watching short clips online. So, you know, it could be, you know, one of those situations where both things can be true at the same time. It's an effort to appease the Trump administration, and it's also a cost-saving measure for the network.
Yeah, it's interesting because, look, Ben, I mean, obviously we're talking Colbert here, but, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, Seth Meyers, these other shows, these aren't exactly wonderful Trump-loving shows either. So I know there's a political slant to this, but I'm wondering here if people are reading too much into that and not enough of what you just said. I mean, Mr. Colbert is rumored to make about $15 million a year. Then you have the theater rental, the union costs. And one thing, Ben, I always remind people about, and you obviously agree with this, I would think, yeah, all these guys are funny. Not really. It's their writers who are very funny as well, and they get paid big bucks.
Absolutely. People behind the scenes. And also, because this production is based in New York City, whenever they do California-based or entertainment-based programming, they have to fly the people in and put them up in hotels. So there is a lot more cost than it may seem for a program like this, especially when it is done so often and, you know, 4 nights a week, 5 nights a week. And sort of a live tape format like that. It's a very expensive proposition. But again, on the other hand, it also fits into the overall narrative that people are watching more clips online, listening to podcasts for their information. And so CBS is thinking, is this really a cost-effective way to make money, or can we repurpose the money we're spending there onto our streaming services, which are growing in popularity?
Or you wonder, Ben, and somebody at the station here said, what do you think CBS is going to do? You know, Ben, I could see them maybe saying, hey, do we find one of these influencers, right, that you and I just mentioned, We don't have to pay them Colbert money. It'll give us an angle toward a much younger demo. It'll be a shorter show with a faster pace show. I'm sure, Ben, I would think that they're looking at something like that, but maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think the Colbert has to be thinking about doing that as well. You know, he doesn't necessarily need a network behind him to do the show and talk about the things he wants. And for him, it could be almost a blessing in the sense that he won't have to worry about pressure from the network, what he wants to say and do. He can get his own podcast, he can get his own Substack. A lot of journalists who have been laid off, a lot of entertainers, you know, have decided to, you know, go that route because they think they can, you know, make money based on their self producing their own content, and they don't have to answer to anyone. So,
yeah,
you know, it's one of those things where that is where the entertainment industry is going. It's a lot of self-produced content rather than content produced by networks.
Sure, and Ben, and the guest is Ben Bogardus, Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Journalism, Chair of the Journalism Department. Ben, also, you would think that if the show was making gangbuster money, the corporate sales department at CBS would say, no, what are you doing? We need this to make money. So there's got to be an angle to that there, Ben, with a younger audience, younger media buyers, and the fact that these aren't the days of 20, 30 million people watching network television anymore from the traditional networks.
Yeah, exactly. And you think back into, you know, the Johnny Carson days and things like that. That was, you know, must-see TV. That was water cooler talk the next morning.
Yeah.
Because media these days is so diverse and so spread out, and people get their information any number of ways, you really can't compare that to what it was. And yes, you know, late shows like that are an institution, but if it doesn't make financial or economic sense anymore, the networks aren't going to continue it just because it's been that way for the last 50 years. They're going to look for what's the next thing to make us money.
And you know, Ben, finally, you know, it's not like CBS and Paramount and Paramount Plus. It's not like they don't have programming they could put in there. Heck, re-rack the CBS Evening News and put it in there. I, being a nerd and a self-avowed Trekkie, I don't know, you have, what, 15 Star Trek series in there? Run one of those there. It's not like they don't have stuff on the shelf.
Yeah, absolutely. But what they're also thinking is they don't want to cannibalize their streaming properties, because in streaming, if someone doesn't have to subscribe to the stream, they can just watch Star Trek at 11 o'clock at night. Why would they subscribe? So, this is a business-based decision that a lot of the, you know, people who, you know, may love the programming are looking at the numbers and saying, this isn't where it's going. And in 10 years, we're, you know, not going to make any money at all, so we might as well get out now and find the next best thing that's going to come along.
Ben Bogardus, Quinnipiac University. Ben, always good to hear from you. Be good, and we'll chat down the road. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Quinnipiac University Associate Professor of Journalism and Chair of the Journalism Department, Ben Bogardus. Two words that won't go away, Jeffrey Epstein. Man, oh man, there is something, there isn't something. This will bring down Biden and the Democrats. This will bring down Trump and the Republicans. One of Epstein's former attorneys says there's nothing there. There's no client list. He committed suicide. No, he was whacked. All right, there you go. There you have it. Joining us with his perspective right now, one of our frequent guests, former Time Magazine senior reporter, Professor Emeritus Political Science, St. Peter's University, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Very good, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm not too bad. And, Professor, with your background, and you're also an attorney, I believe, this has to fascinate you even more, because now I'm seeing that, you know, grand jury testimony is being brought into this. I mean, what, looking at this from both ends of this, the political end and the legal end, what do you make of this?
Well, politically, I think it really the whole story really tells me, be careful what you ask for. You know, the Trump folks, President Trump and his MAGA supporters have been asking for years to release the so-called Epstein files. I'm confident that there is some dirt there about various people, various elite people, who knows who. Well, now that, of course, Trump is in control of the Justice Department, all of a sudden Trump doesn't want those documents released, and one, therefore, has to ask why. On the legal front, that's a little clearer in the sense that grand jury proceedings are supposed to be secret.
Yeah.
And so if you're asking for the release of those documents, you better have a very strong reason. And the judge will be the ultimate, decider of that. You have to have a very strong reason because lots of people get mentioned in grand jury proceedings, some of whom are just mentioned, ad hoc. And you don't want to hurt the reputation of people who are sort of incidentally mentioned or anybody who's mentioned who the prosecutors don't want to indict for whatever reason. Then also you've got the issue that Mr. Epstein's partner, her name escapes me at the moment.
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yes, Ms. Maxwell,
yeah.
Has been convicted, and she's appealing her case. And because she's appealing her case, you don't want to release grand jury documents that she might use, perhaps, to say that her case has been prejudiced as a result of the release of those documents. So there are lots of reasons why the grand jury proceedings probably are going to be kept secret, or if anything is released, it'll be very minimal stuff. But beyond that, whatever is in the grand jury proceedings is just a small bit of material compared to what is alleged to be the broad Epstein files. So the question still remains, what is in these broader files that the Trump administration now does not want to release?
You know, and Professor, this has kind of been lumped in, I don't think uber accurately, but I see the angle here, with whenever we get promises to release files on assassinations, Bobby Kennedy Sr., Martin Luther King, JFK, oh, we're going to release everything. Well, no, you're not, because even if all those people are dead, and I'm drawing a loose comparison here, Professor, there are things, I am sure, in some of these Epstein files where maybe both sides of the aisle look at each other and say, hey, it ain't worth the political advantage to either one of us, right? What are your thoughts on that? There could be stuff here that really would, wound the public psyche, if you know what I mean here?
Yeah. Well, look, it's very clear that Mr. Epstein had friends in high places. I mean, we know that.
Mm.
Certainly he was friendly with President Trump before Mr. Trump became president, and with other high-profile business people and politicians. Now, that doesn't mean that any of those politicians participated in the sordid criminal activities of Mr. Epstein. But nonetheless, you're associated with him. You met him. You were at a party. You had a meeting with him, whatever. And so a lot of people probably don't want those records to be revealed, whether they're Republicans or whether they're Democrats. But on the other hand, as I said, Trump made a big part of his campaign,
yeah,
both the first time and the second time, about there are all these kinds of conspiracies. He's going to clean up the swamp. There are all kinds of shenanigans that the elite of this country have done at the expense of ordinary people. And so that worked for him very well electorally. But now that he's in control of the files, he's a little more concerned because either those files would contain materials that might be compromising for him, not necessarily illegal activities, but just compromising for some of his friends. Now, I should point out that there's a breaking story on the Hill right now that says that Senator Durbin, who's the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee, he says in a letter to Pam Bondi that he's received information that Attorney General Bondi pressured about 1,000 FBI personnel to comb through thousands of pages of Epstein documents and to flag any mention of President Trump. Now, is that true?
Oh, boy.
Who knows? Who knows? But the fact is there are layers and layers. This is like an onion. You know, you peel it and there are more and more layers. It's not clear whether Dick Durbin's allegations have any merit. But nonetheless, that's yet another piece of the onion that is going to be unraveled. And so one doesn't know. But the thing, as I say, be careful what you ask.
Yeah.
Because that's something that many people forget in political life and in normal life.
And you know, Professor, just to end here, I had a correspondent from CBS News on the other day. We're a CBS affiliate here. And Olivia Rinaldi said she had been out earlier this week shadowing the vice president and his family as they were taking a little summer vacation going around. And from a distance, she could hear people chatting with Mr. Vance. And she said the only questions anybody was asking him, Jeffrey Epstein. So there you go.
Right. Right. Now, you know, we have to wait and see how this is going to play out in MAGA world. Initially, of course, the MAGA people want these documents to be released because they've been promised that they would be released for years. But now that the Wall Street Journal has published a report that says that Trump sent a bawdy birthday letter to to Jeffrey Epstein, Trump has now attacked the Wall Street Journal, and more broadly speaking, the mainstream media. So a lot of MAGA people are saying, yeah, that's right, you know, the mainstream media is fake news and so forth. So you've got yet another layer here. A lot of MAGA people are now saying, well, maybe this isn't true what the Wall Street Journal is saying, and if it isn't true, maybe Trump is right not to release the I mean, this is such a convoluted story now that making any sense out of it until we get more information is a futile effort.
Former Time Magazine senior reporter, professor emeritus, political science, St. Peter's University in New Jersey City, frequent contributor, Professor Alan Sanders. Professor, thank you as always. Be good. Have a happy weekend. We'll talk. Thank you.
You too. Take care.
All right. There you go.